Welcome back to the Combat Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Peacock, 4-3 black belt in Taekwondo and a martial arts skill training specialist. If you're new to the show, please sign up to the Combat Learning newsletter at combatlearning.com/newsletter. I'll send you cheat sheets on how to transform your drills into maximum skill building games and get you up to speed on the science of motor skill learning for martial arts. Plus, you'll never miss a show. Go to combatlearning.com/newsletter. To get those resources now. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Raul Sanchez Garcia, a sports science lecturer at the Universidad Politécnica of Madrid, Spain, a martial artist and an ecological dynamics thinker. Most researchers in the ecological approach come from a psychology background. Dr. Garcia is unique in that he approaches ecological dynamics from the vantage point of ethnography, which is the systematic study of people and their cultures. In that vein, he wrote a fantastic social history on the development of Japanese martial arts. In this episode, Dr. Garcia walks us through the historic significance of kata based on his research, or rather, how it was not significant, or at least not ubiquitous, in the war-torn pre-restoration periods of Japan. Rather, it is only after war becomes a less common part of life that kata rises in popularity as a training tool. Kata heads will no doubt be scandalized at this revelation, as will traditionalists from other styles. But even if you're a non-traditional martial artist, this information will be interesting and useful for your own understanding of the current training landscape. It isn't just about kata, it's about any sort of rote training modality. So if you're excited to jump in, hit the subscribe button on your podcatcher and enjoy the show. And if you're listening on YouTube, be sure to hit that like button too. All right. Welcome to the Combat Learning Podcast. I'm very excited about my guest today. Go ahead and introduce yourself to my listeners.
Okay. Yes. Thank you for having me here. I'm Raul Sánchez García, a lecturer in sports science at the Universidad Politécnica de Madrid in Spain. Basically, my main topics of research, although I have a diverse approach, but to skill acquisition, that's the thing that we're talking about here. I approach it through ethnography. So it's not that I came from psychology, that's maybe this is the main area that researchers comes to, right, to skill acquisition, but I came from ethnography. So through this and ethnomethodology, I conducted different studies on the interactions of, for instance, in my thesis was about interactions and negotiation of violence in boxing, but also in Aikido. So I tried to compare these two different settings and how participants get to know the standard, what we call the standard of intensity or violence, mm-hmm, or whatever you want to call it. So my first approach was through this, but later on, as I had to give some lectures on motor learning, I got really into all these different theories and the debate between information processing and ecological approach. And so, I got more and more into this, and I started to do research with people from ecological dynamics, like, for instance, Duarte Araujo and the group that it's really big and growing here in Europe. For instance, even though the main group is UK, but also Australia and New Zealand, but in continental Europe, we have also some researchers. And I know that Rob Gray is doing a great job in US, spreading, mm-hmm, the word. And yeah, people like you and the guys that you're interviewing, I think you're really doing a good job connecting the academic world to people, you know, that they're not so connected to this. And yeah, I by chance last month or 2 months ago, I get into your conversations with Greg Saunders, and I thought that was great because I mean, you were trying to really to apply that to coaching and to, in this case, combat sports and martial arts. Mm-hmm. That is so my main thing, you know. So yeah, I was fascinated by that. So
I appreciate that, yeah. Man. Yeah, that was the point of the podcast from the start, and it remains mm-hmm. the point now, 3 years on, to mm-hmm. take the ecological dynamics and make it approachable and practical for coaches. Mm-hmm. I know some people, they don't like, I use some of the technical terms because I want coaches to understand some of those terms, but for the most part, I think starting to make a dent. More people are getting interested in it and learning how to use it. Cool, man.
Okay, so last word about my background in martial sure. arts and sports. So yeah, I practiced some judo and karate when I was a kid, but then with my thesis, I really started to get into boxing, kickboxing, and aikido at the same time because I had to do the research. And then I continued for some time, and I practice also sistema, and now I'm doing some grappling also, even though I did some BJJ, but more is grappling nowadays. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've been in the gyms for a long time.
Let's say. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're not just a researcher, you're a martial artist too.
Yeah, that's the point. That for me, if you stay just in the academic field, sometimes it's so hard to make these transitions or to build these bridges because you lack the practicalities of the action. So sometimes it's really difficult to bring something relevant. Mm-hmm. So for me, you have to have both legs, you know, maybe one in the academic and but the other in the practical, in the floor, in the gym, let's say.
Yeah. Yeah. Touching the touching the mat. You got to have one foot on the mat at least. Awesome, dude. So I'm fascinated by martial arts history, and the ecological approach hasn't changed that at all. I don't quite read as much as I used to on it, but I know that you're also very much interested in that. You wrote an entire social history. Is that how you would describe it, a social history of Japanese martial arts?
Yeah. In fact, it's a kind of sociology. It's called process sociology because it takes into account the long-term development. Mm-hmm. So for me, this is also really relevant because sometimes we think that changes in techniques or how people at certain societies, certain time approach these fighting techniques or fighting systems. But we lose sight of the fact that many of these changes are not due or mainly due to practitioners itself, but due to broader context, you know? Mm. So the thing about kata and all that maybe we can talk about in a while, but the way to transmit martial arts through kata has a lot to do with the context, you know? And it's mm-hmm. you cannot take this out of the equation because otherwise you're not understanding what was going on. Because if you think that it was something related with efficiency of teaching, for instance, maybe you're losing the broader picture, you know. So you want us to start in there, the kata thing, or should
yeah, let's talk about kata. That's my background's traditional martial arts. I do jiu-jitsu, of course, people know that, but the kata is a constant point of discussion in most of the circles that I run in. So I'd love to talk about the historical development of kata, and then talk about kata versus sparring throughout the development of Japanese martial arts. Yes, take it away.
Okay. So first of all, we need to understand that the originators of Japanese martial ryu or schools, let's call it I mean, we're talking about a very long, long time ago, like the two courts period. There's like two cycles of violence in ancient Japanese history. That is the two courts period, about 14th century, and the warring states or Sengoku period. That is end of the 15th until the 1600. Okay, so in these two very violent periods, there were well-seasoned battlefield warriors and veterans that after that, they honed their skills in what was called Musashugyo, but it's like warrior pilgrimage, where they were doing kind of duels, one-on-one duels against others. And in some sense, this was a quasi study situation, you know, because in the battlefield, you're surrounded by many, many people, but one-on-one, you can focus more on just one person and develop or study better the situation. In fact, many of them, they were not using life blades. Sometimes they did, but many times they just used a bucket, you know, a sword made of hard wood. Because, in fact, they were not really interested in killing the other person, but in understanding better their style and developing better their style and maybe find some master in, you know. So, for instance, one of these warriors, the founder of Shinkage Ryu, that it was Kamitsune Nobutsuna, he designed in 16th century a weapon called Fukuro Sinai, a cloth bamboo sword instead of a normal boken. And he was talking about using that to make the encounter less dangerous, more interesting to understand. The nature of combat, right? Mm-hmm. So, but what happened? What happened with the pacification of the country in 1600 with the Tokugawa? Martial arts development and study changed drastically. Why? Now that it was everything pacified and there was no way, warriors were not allowed to do this Musashugyo or to fight each other. So they had to transmit their style or their knowledge through kata that were prearranged form, practicing verse. That was not something that was only used in martial arts. It was used in any form or art of art. And one thing that was required through the kata was to strictly follow the hierarchy. You know, there's a master and this is the, let's say, the curriculum of the style. You have to know that you have to, but you're not allowed just to, as a student, just to challenge that, or you know, it, as everything was more restricted and real fights were not allowed anymore. So in this sense, this kata training gained predominance, and you have to understand that at that time, many of these samurai that were, some of them, they were low-ranking samurai. If they were not hired by the han, the domain, you know, like there were different domains in Japan with the daimyo. So if they were hired by the domain, okay, they were going to make a good living. But if not, they have to survive and they have to sell some of their warrior skills that were not useful in the battlefield anymore. So they had to make a living out of teaching, you know. So teaching now in indoor facilities, that is the dojo with a smooth surface, with, you know, everything was prepared for this kata to be the main transmission tool, because in this sense you can have an order curriculum and you have your students and you can get your fees out of these students. So it was very suitable, very convenient for them, you know, as the pacification phase unfolded, and I'm talking from 1600 until the end of the 19th century. So as this period unfolded, the samurai were forced also to give lessons to commoners that were paying in you know, to get these lessons. So what I'm saying is that kata has a lot to do with the contextual social conditions of the era. So because teaching martial arts became a profession for some of these instructors, so it was much more convenient for them to make it like this, you know.
Yeah.
But I can tell, because there's some documents talking about that some warriors were already criticizing this kind of kata only kata teaching. They were calling that, flowery swordplay, kaho kempo. They were calling that, you know, because at that time, you know, I'm talking about the 17th century, because they knew at that time that if you just practice this kata, it's going to get more and more distant from the efficiency and efficacy of the combat, and you're going to embellish the actions, the movements, and that's why they were calling that, you know. Mm. And yeah, and also in 1700 we find the first recorded, at least that I know, a controversy about the most suitable method for training, you know, that appear in at that time, where some sword schools, mainly sword schools, but there were also some with naginata, mm-hmm. that they were introducing protective gear to make some sparring, you know, but because they knew that it was really important. And at that time is when the split bamboo sword called shinai, mm-hmm. was used as well in this sparring context, because it was a safer option than mm-hmm. the wooden bokuto to make this sparring more attractive and life.
And
you know?
Kendo comes out of that tradition. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Okay. Later on, through, because it has to, I mean, we're talking about a long-term development, you know? Right. So, but you can see here that there are some schools that just remain with the kata, and they were others that were using protective gear and went to the sparring. So the kata schools, they were criticizing the others because they were saying, oh, but the mental attitude and everything is not the same, because it's not a duel to death and it's just competitive sport, fun, whatever, you know. But the reality is that by the end of the 18th century, even though most of the Ryu had merged both methods to different extents, those who were favoring the sparring approach were much more successful than the mm-hmm. kata. The kata ones, they started to be more secluded and more into not open to a wide audience, especially in the big cities, you know, in Tokyo or these cities where commoners were entering more and more, attracted also by this more fun and life and joyful experience, you know. By the end of the 17th century and in the 18th century, as I said, a competition between private academies sparked again the discussion on kata versus full contact sparring. So some of this competition among academies was permitted. Also, the practices of what was called dojo jaburi, that it's go to other school and challenge the student or the master, and if you're victorious, you're going to get the students. So at that time, some of these things were happening, and also there was a market for competitive for some competition, you know. So it get like commercialized, this kind of competition between different schools, and you know, that's the interesting thing also is that these schools, the ones that privilege free sparring, not only attracted more students, but they were they had a crucial role in the events surrounding the fall of the Tokugawa shogunate by the second half of the 19th century. So at that time, when the Western powers forced Japan to open the borders, some of these samurai warriors, they felt betrayed and they want to start a revolt. So the ones that started this revolt were connected throughout all the country with this network of dojo that were connected to free sparring. So what I'm saying is that they were really more used to combat or real action, you know. And that's an interesting point, you know, to understand that. So what I'm saying is that even at that time, they were really conscious about, at least that was really controversial to think that kata was the main or the only way to transmit it. So during a period, it was like that because the society was really closed and rigid and hierarchical, and any kind of life combat was not really fostered because the Tokugawa, they wanted to keep the samurai really low in their warrior spirit. So they wanted to convert them into retainers. So that's why during a period it was just kata. But after in mid Tokugawa and late Tokugawa, we can see that the sparring thing and the life training went upwards, you know, because of that. And what I want to say is that this, even though it seems that it's not connected to the main topic of info processing and ecological dynamics, is really connected. And here's why. People used to say, or I've heard that, and maybe you have heard that in your training, that, oh, no. Kata is so good because you're repeating the movement again and again and again, and you get some muscle memory, and that get in your muscle and your brain and blah, 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 blah. Right. So this is the main assumption in the info processing approach, the assumption of the drill. You know, the drill, the drill. And that's why drilling comes from there. Drill is you're going to poke a hole through doing the same and the same and the same and the same. And the drill is like generating a neural path. That's the main idea, you know? So you're going to generate a neural path because you're going to repeat, and then it's going to get automatic, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, for me, and this is one thing that's, for instance, Bernstein, that was one of the main authors for ecological dynamics, mm-hmm. was really against that at the very during the first half of the 20th century. He already acknowledged that that was a false assumption.
Thanks so much for listening to the Combat Learning Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. It really helps us out. Finally, this episode, including the intro music, is produced by Micah Peacock. Thanks in advance, and I'll see you on the next episode.